Harvest Messages are brought to you by Harvest Partners. To receive free email daily devotions or to become a Harvest Partner, please visit us online at harvest.org.
Before yesterday, and they had one day to learn it, and didn't they do an amazing job? And we're so thankful that they did. Otherwise, it would have been me up here singing it for you, and that would never have done well. But just a little background on that hymn writer. His name is William Cooper. If you want to look him up, you spell his name K-O-W-P-E-R, but it's pronounced Cooper. He was a contemporary of John Newton, the man who wrote Amazing Grace, the old slave trader turned evangelist and minister. And William Cooper suffered all of his life from the time he was a young boy until he was taken up to heaven with unbelievable bouts of depression. Robert, is this microphone kind of doing a weird echoey thing? He suffered with tremendous bouts of depression, and I mean really extreme depression. Even as a believer who trusted and knew the Lord, he still went through it. And out of that agony and out of that pain came a hymn like that, that is just so full of faith and trust in the Lord. You know, you fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and will break with blessings on your head. And he also wrote, There is a Fountain Filled with Blood, and many other hymns, just beautiful. Would you turn in your Bibles, not to the book of Ruth first, but turn to the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 1, and I'm going to begin reading to you from verse 1. This is what Matthew, or Levi, wrote for us. This is the genealogy of Jesus the Messiah, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and Isaac the father of Jacob, and Jacob the father of Judah and his brothers. Remember those guys, those 12 brothers? And Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Perez was the father of Hezron, Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram, the father of Amminadab. Amminadab, the father of Nashon. Nashon, the father of Salmon. Salmon, the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother was Ruth. And Obed, the father of Jesse. And Jesse, the father of King David. And David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. When you read that genealogy, and there is another genealogy of Jesus given to us in the Gospel of Luke, but this one is very unique in all the genealogies in the Bible. It is unique because it includes these women, and normally genealogies are genealogies of men, father to son, and on and on. But this genealogy tells us of these four women, and it's almost as if Matthew, right in the beginning of the first book of the New Testament, is giving us a clue that if we want to understand the life and work and ministry and significance of the God-man, our Savior Jesus Christ, we've got to understand the background of these women. And it is so beautiful to know the background of Tamar, who produced a son who was in the line of the Messiah through an incestuous relationship with her father-in-law, Judah. And then we go to the story of Rahab, who was always called, as Trish pointed out last week, Rahab the harlot, who was a prostitute who came into the line of the Messiah. As we found out, she was the mother of Boaz. Did that ever connect in your mind as you were studying the story? And then on down from there, and then we have Ruth, a Moabite, a cursed nation, cursed by God himself, idol-worshipping nation. Ruth the Moabite, also in the line of the Messiah. And then on down to what Matthew records as Solomon, whose mother was, or had been, Uriah's wife. Not David's wife, Uriah's wife. He is telling us that right there, the gospel is all about broken, messed up people, right? And so we belong, don't we? In those days, genealogies were far more significant and important than they are to us today. You know, it's kind of trendy to look up your genealogy. You can do that. You could have your DNA tested, and they will tell you basically what part of the world you're from, very specific part of the world you're from. And I'm so tempted to do that. I would love to know, because not what you're told. The DNA tests do not lie. You know, we tend to forget about the outlaws and the things that we don't like to remember and places we're from in our ancestry, but that tells the truth. But here we have the truthful genealogy of Jesus, and if you want to know who Jesus is, you look at his genealogy. You want to know in those days who someone was and what made them who they were, you would look at their genealogy. You would say, well, who's your father? As a matter of fact, often their names are son of. Ben means son of. You know, you hear Ben Hadad or Ben this or Benjamin means son of. And so you would identify yourself with your forefathers. Well, today, you know, we don't think of things like that. We don't think of, I don't even know who your parents are. I mean, I know some of my dearest friends here. I know nothing about their parents, nor do I really care much about who their parents were. We, as Americans, and we in Western society, we think of ourselves as individuals. And we stand on our own accomplishments, on our resumes, and the way I know who you are, apart from seeing you, and being introduced to you by name, I would know who you are by perhaps what your career is. I would ask you what you do. I would ask you where you live. I would ask you what accomplishments you have. I'd ask you who you know. It would be very much an individual representation of who you are. It wouldn't matter who your parents were, right? But what Matthew was saying right here in the very first, and we are studying simply Jesus still. I don't want you to get your eyes on Ruth and Boaz and Naomi so much. I want you to think about Jesus in this story. And Matthew is telling us is if we want to understand who Jesus is and the story of the Bible, we have to look at Jesus' family tree. And we see the history of all mankind. We see it right there before us. And it isn't a pretty one. And what is so interesting about this genealogy, unlike many other genealogies in the Bible, is that they're women, and not just one or two. There are quite a few women that are mentioned in this genealogy. And it is a fascinating story. Read up sometime. Maybe as you're going into Christmas, the story of Tamar, the story of Rahab and Ruth, and of Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. But even though Ruth is a short book, and aren't we so happy after many chapters of reading, we only had four chapters this week, and we could really dive deep, it's still a lot in this book, and there are so many rabbit trails we could go on, wonderful points we could pick out and talk about this morning, but I am going to just give you the bookends and some highlights of this story, okay? And I know it's familiar with all of you because you studied it this week, but I'm just going to just tell it to you one more time. Sometimes it's great to hear it instead of broken up over 7 days to hear it all in one sweep. So I'm going to give you three points to this story. The first one is the devastation of Naomi. The second one is the courage of Ruth. Okay, I know you're writing fast. Devastation of Naomi, the courage of Ruth, and the last point is the redemption. And I was going to say of Ruth and Naomi, but it's actually the redemption of every one of us in this room. So the devastation of Naomi. Naomi is married to a man named Elimelech, whose name means our God is king. And our God is king is living in a town called Bethlehem. This is during the time of the judges. We have moved from the wilderness wanderings. We are now in the land of Canaan. There have been battles, there have been conquests, and each tribe has been given its ancestral land. We don't know how deep we are into the story of Judges, but what we know of the story of Judges is that we were told that every man was doing what was right in his own eyes. And it was not a glorious period of history to be living in. Even though you were Israelites, and you were worshiping the true God or knew the true God and had the commandments of God, every man was kind of doing his own thing. There was no king in Israel at that time. There was a lot of compromise. These tribes have moved into the land. They didn't destroy the people as they were supposed to. They didn't tear down their high places, and many of them went into idol worship. And the idols, those tribal deities that were existing in the land of Canaan, were brutal gods. As a matter of fact, the God that that was over the land of Moab was, his name meant destroyer. They practiced infant sacrifices. And these Canaanite gods infiltrated and were mixed in amongst and blended with their true religion, Judaism, and worship of Yahweh. And they picked and chose, and it was a mess. And what we see here is that Elimelech decides, because there is a famine, interestingly enough, in the house of bread, which is what the name Bethlehem means, there's a famine in the house of bread, he is going to uproot his family from the land that God had given him and move into Moab, simply because he had heard there was bread in Moab. And I don't mean to minimize starvation and famine. And I think as a man wanting to make the right decisions for his family, I can see the pressure of making some important decisions. But you never make those important decisions at the jeopardy and the compromise of your commitment and your responsibility to be a spiritual leader to that family. Well, Elimelech had two sons, and they were named Mahlon and Chilion, by the way. It's spelled C-H, but it's pronounced like Chilion. They took their two sons, he took his wife Naomi, and they moved. What is interesting about those two boys' names, and I know you've heard them before, sickly and wasting or sickly and pining, but actually these are Canaanite names. These are not Hebrew names. We have a little bit of insight, and that came from Kaufman's commentary, insight into Elimelech's mindset. At some point, it seems, Elimelech has had his heart somewhat turned away from Yahweh, and afraid of poverty and death for his family, he moves and seeks life outside of the boundaries of the promised land. But instead of finding wealth and security and food and prosperity, disaster strikes, and first he dies, and then his two sons die. And Naomi is left, and she is so lost because she has lost everything. She's lost her husband, and then she's lost her two sons. You have to understand that widows in the Bible were the most vulnerable of all people. Widows were the most socially and economically compromised. They had no resources. And you take a widow, not only a widow, but an old widow, and the fact that she has no children, she basically is left with nothing. Nowadays, you know, we would say, well, what's the big deal? You know, I mean, yes, it's difficult to be a widow. Yes, it's difficult to not have a family or children. But, you know, women can make their own way in the world. They can travel. They can seek employment. They can do a number of things. We have so much we take for granted as women nowadays. But in these days, women didn't travel alone. Women didn't go out and seek employment elsewhere. Basically, when things got really hard, basically what you would do is you would sell yourself into slavery. That was your one option. You would become an indentured servant. Maybe that would have been Naomi's only option. Today we have our education, we have skills, perhaps we have money. But in those days, it was family for women, husbands and children. So what does she do? She has been completely devastated, Naomi is, and we see how empty it is. How hard it is for us in our culture to understand what happened in her life and how she felt. Just looking at Naomi's situation, some of us might think this is primitive, this is unfair. We are women, we are entitled to make our own way in the world. We have every bit of and every right to pursue our own careers and our own choices and make our own decisions. Why, when we look at Naomi's situation, we think of it as backward and restrictive and so forth. But you know what, ladies, every culture, and that was that culture, but our culture today, every culture has its way of telling you whether you're a somebody or whether you're a nobody. In our culture, like I mentioned, it would be your education, it would be your wealth, it would be perhaps your appearance. I mean, you go to a store, you look at the women's magazines. What are we being communicated by those magazines? What are we being told? Well, if you pick up Vogue or Cosmopolitan magazine, you would be told that to be significant, to be somebody, you have to weigh a certain weight, you have to look a certain way, you have to have certain flawless skin, you have to be trendy and dress and behave and do the right things according to their standards. And you say, well, that's awfully shallow. Of course, I'm not like that. You know, I'm educated. I have a career. I have a job. I have skills. And I don't get my identity from my outward appearance. I have my identity from who I am and what I am and what I do. Well, you know, that's another way that you find yourself significant. What happens when you lose that career? What happens when you drop out of school and you don't get that college education? What happens when you're passed over for that promotion? I mean, there's a lot of ways that we can feel significant about our lives, not realizing that at any moment those things could be taken from us. It's interesting. Did you happen to see the movie, the latest Woody Allen movie called Blue Jasmine with Cate Blanchett? Anybody out there see it? Don't be afraid. It was a very interesting movie. It's about a woman, a socialite. She's very wealthy. She lives Upper East or West Side in New York City. She's married to a super successful guy. He's like stockbroker, money trader, hedge fund manager, something like that. And she discovers that, and she's got all these classy friends, and she's got all the right clothes, and she carries the right handbag, and all of a sudden she discovers her husband's had an affair. Bam, her identity right there gets shattered. Then the next thing is he's taken off to jail because it turns out that he's been doing some things under the table that he shouldn't been doing, and they get a divorce, and she has to get a job, and she is one by one by one through this step by step through this movie being taken down. But what is so interesting, and it was pointed out in a New York Times article that Greg mentioned to me the other day when we were talking about how what we look for in our identity, how we get our identity as women today, is that Cate Blanchett, throughout this entire movie, is carrying a handbag. And that handbag, according to this article, is an Hermes Kelly bag that was designed after Grace Kelly. Well, this handbag, ladies, you could see it at a store in South Coast Plaza if you want to, is worth over $10,000. They go all the way up to $10,000 to $18,000, and if it's an alligator Kelly bag, it's worth even like $30,000, something crazy like that. And in this movie, Cate Blanchett is holding this Kelly bag the whole time. There's hardly a scene in the movie where she's not carrying this handbag. This is all she has left of her identity. That's it. It's come down to carrying the right designer bag, and as long as she's got that, she maybe feels a little secure. We look for different things than perhaps Naomi might have looked at. But let me tell you, can you imagine if everything that mattered to you most, and I don't know what it is, apart from your faith in God, apart from your relationship, everything that mattered to you was taken from you suddenly. It would be that kind of devastation for Naomi. And so everything she has been taken away, and she decides she is about to go back to Bethlehem, and she has no prospects and no hope. She is going to live a dead-end life, basically, going back by herself. And at one point in this story, we read how she makes this sad play on her own name. And she goes back into Bethlehem, and the whole town, which it's kind of interesting because Elimelech is called an Ephrathite from Bethlehem, and some commentators believe that that was sort of a class, a noble class, that he actually was from an affluent family. They had sold their ancestral land. They had left. She had gone out with her husband, with her children, with probably a good amount of goods and prosperity, having sold the land, coming from this upper class. They go to Moab, and she leaves full. She leaves town with her Birkin bag or her Kelly bag or whatever in her Louis Vuitton outfit, and she comes back and she has nothing. And the whole town sees her and says, "Who could this be? Naomi? Is that who that is? We hardly recognize her. Look at that." And she says, "Don't call me Naomi." She makes a sad joke about her own name. She says, Don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara. Don't call me sweet, call me bitter, because the Lord's hand has gone out against me. I have gone away full, but I have come back empty. And we see the devastation of Naomi. Then we see the courage of Ruth. And you look at chapter 1, verse 7 and 8, when her daughter-in-laws, Orpah and Ruth, are trying to accompany her as she leaves. And Naomi says something to them that is surprising to us. She says, "Go back." Why is she telling them to go back? Because she sees that they are young, and even though they are widows, they have a good prospect of remarrying and finding a husband if they go back. And if they have parents, they have a home to go back to and find shelter and comfort and sustenance and a way to live. But she's not just thinking about them going back to their family. She's also thinking what would happen if they came with her. And what she was about to do was to take them on a trip, on a traveling trip, three women alone, traveling in the desert, going from Moab, which is on the eastern side of the Dead Sea, out in the desert, going from Moab up through the desert and going up to Bethlehem. The elevation in Bethlehem is pretty significant. It can snow there in the wintertime. And from that elevation in Bethlehem, you have the one of the lowest points on earth, which is the Dead Sea. So they're going to make this treacherous journey. It's not that far in miles. It's like 60 miles, I read. It's not that far in distance. You could probably walk 60 miles in a week. But it's the terrain that they would have to go on foot. Three women traveling alone. It was a dangerous journey, not just because it was difficult, and not just because you would be walking through wadis where if there was a sudden rain, these wadis would flood and you could be swept away, not only because of the hills and the rocks and the snakes and the other things that were there, but this was a dangerous road because this is the same road that is called the road to Jericho that went from Bethlehem down to that part of the country. And that was where the man, remember, who was beaten on the road to Jericho and the Good Samaritan came. It was fraught with bandits because it was an isolated, you were not near any major towns, you were out in the wilderness, and there were robbers and there were rapists and there were murderers that would be along that road. And you have three women. It's unheard of in those days for women to travel alone without a husband, without a brother, without a father to protect them. They would never have done this. But Naomi is going to do this, and she's thinking, I cannot take these girls. I cannot jeopardize their futures, their chances to find a home, to find a husband, to be safe. But even when they get to the land, she knows what the prospects might be for a Moabite. This was a despised race. These were the enemies of Israel. These women would not be respected. They would not be cared for. They would not be welcomed. They would be ostracized. And in some ways, the life that they would lead in Bethlehem with her, if they survived the journey, would have been harder for them than if they stayed in Moab. And there's that chilling account in chapter 2, verse 8, when Ruth is gleaning in the fields and she has a conversation with Boaz, and he says to her, "Stay with my girls. Don't go out. Don't go out of this field. I've ordered my men not to touch you, because in someone else's field, you might be harmed." That was not just him being overly protective. You know how my husband doesn't want me to drive at night. This is not overly protective. This is a man who knew the real possibilities of what could happen to Ruth if she was just out there on her own, without a protector, without a father, a husband, and being a Moabite. Later on in that same chapter, Naomi says the same thing to her. "Stay in his field, my daughter. Don't leave his field." She knows, Naomi knows, of the racial discrimination that would be targeted, the hatred for the Moabites, and she knows every single day they could be the objects of violence. So she says, "Go back." She says, "Go back." And that is so awesome that she would be willing to say that. But Ruth doesn't go back. And in chapter 1, verse 16, she says, "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And where you die, I will die. And where you will be buried, there I will be buried. And may the Lord, may Yahweh, your God, deal ever so severely with me if anything separate me from you but death." Naomi and Ruth understand the danger. We hear that lovely little, where you go, I will go. Those are like the verses that are quoted in wedding brochures or wedding things, you know. Where you die, where you go, I will go. Your people will be my people. We never read about, and where you die, I will die, and the Lord deal ever so severely with me, if anything but death. That, you kind of conveniently leave that part out. But Ruth is saying a real possibility here of her own death and her own being destroyed with Naomi. She knew what it was going to cost her to go. And the courage of Ruth to take this on, to take on the journey, to go with her back to Bethlehem, to face what she might face. She's willing to go. Every act of immigration is drastic. I mean, we've all heard stories about in Vietnam, how when the communist North Vietnamese took over South Vietnam and Saigon fell, how many of those Vietnamese people got into boats in the open seas and tried to make their way to Australia, and they were in this subject to pirates, and they were, many of them died, many of those boats were capsized, and the ones that survived speak of the harrowing journey that it was. And in Orange County, there's a couple sisters that are from the Ukraine, whose father was an evangelist in the Ukraine, and during the time when Russia was occupying the Ukraine, their father was put into prison for 10 years. And the decision to immigrate, to get out, as soon as he was released from prison, they left everything. They were from an upper-class Russian family. They left everything behind in order to find freedom, and they are so grateful for the freedom they have in this country. As a matter of fact, her father is back in the Ukraine now, as trying to minister to the churches over there, at the risk of his life, because who knows what's going to happen for them. But every act of immigration is drastic. And many of us are, all of us Americans, if you go back far enough, we're all the children of immigrants. But immigrants come hoping for a better life, right? They don't leave because they're just on a vacation. They're leaving because they're where they were in their homes. It was terrible. There was either persecution or famine, or there was no prospect. So they come to a land where they're hoping for a better life. Some of them found it, some of them struggled. But it's always in hope for something better. But here Naomi, and this is my point about her courage, is she's not hoping for a better life. She's saying, where you die, I will die. I am following you, Naomi, and I am following your God. The courage of Ruth. That is one of the most amazing speeches in the whole Bible. It's almost like she's saying, I'm going to give it all up to follow you. And isn't that what Jesus tells us to do when we become his disciples? That we'd be willing to turn our back on parents and on family and on everything to follow him. And that is what the courage of Naomi shows us here in this. Now the third part is the part of redemption. This is the redemption of us all. Ruth and Naomi make it back, but they are in destitute, abject poverty. Who knows what they could carry for a week in the desert, but probably only the bare essentials, water, food, maybe just something to shelter themselves with in the open nights. But they come back into Jerusalem, back into Bethlehem, and they are so poor. Who knows what they found? Did they go back to her ancestral plot of land that had been abandoned for 10 years and everything all overgrown? Maybe the stone hut was broken down. Maybe there'd been animals living in it, and they scurry out whatever is there, trying to make a safe place to stay for the night, and they come back with nothing and no food. But at least they're back in the land, and they made the journey safely. And the next day, Ruth gets up and she says, I'm going to go glean in the fields. We got to find something to eat. And she gets up and she happens to stumble upon this field of Boaz. And it's so beautiful because it's springtime, you know. It's springtime in the promised land. It's the time of the barley harvest. And it would have been the time of Passover. It's interesting, you know, how we heard last week about how the Israelites celebrated Passover before they entered into the promised land. Well, here is Naomi and Ruth coming back into the promised land. And they've come back to not much, but it is springtime, and God is at work in this story. And Ruth goes out to glean in the fields, which is what the poor can do. After the reapers go through the fields, there would often be bits of broken stalks here and there. And the poor were allowed, they couldn't go through their fields more than once, the reapers and owners of the field. They were to leave what they dropped in the field for the poor. And so Ruth goes out and she is picking up these bits of broken barley to gather up in hopes that she gets enough grain, just enough to go home and have a meal that night for herself and for Naomi. And she works from sunup to sundown. And she threshes what's left and she's about to leave and Boaz comes on the scene. She just happens to be gleaning in the field of Boaz. Don't you just love that? In the old King James, it says it was her hap to go into the field of this man named Boaz. And that means it was her luck. It was her good fortune. And it's almost as, you know, these Bible stories, you have to understand they were written by people who were under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit. But there's almost this little wink, wink, nod, nod in this when he says it was just so happened that she's in the field of Boaz. And when Boaz hears about who she is, he says, "Whose damsel is this?" And he hears about who she is and how she has come back, knowing the courage and the sacrifice of Ruth to come back from Moab with an old mother-in-law who has nothing to offer her, and she's been gleaning in the fields from sunup to sundown. He is amazed and impressed, and he goes to speak to her. And she is equally amazed and impressed that he would speak to her, knowing that he is the owner of the field and that he is gracious to her and concerned about her. And that she says, "I found grace in your eyes that any Israelite man would speak to me, a Moabite, a poor, destitute Moabite woman." And she tells him that she is amazed. And when she goes home, with not just the handful of broken grain, but with more, Naomi sees it, and Naomi knows something's going on here. And she says, "What is all of this? Where have you been today?" And Ruth just says, "Well, I just happened to be gleaning in this field of this man named Boaz." And Naomi says, "You can't believe this. This is amazing. He is one of the few people in this town who could be our kinsman redeemer." And the rest of the story hinges on that amazing occurrence. Well, we learned what a kinsman redeemer was. A kinsman redeemer was a close relative who had the right to buy back the land that one would either lose or one would sell or forfeit, and give back that land, not for himself, but for the one who had lost it. You see, when the Israelites came into the land, when Joshua divided up the land between the tribes, every family, everyone was given a plot of land. But Naomi and her husband had chosen to leave that land, to forfeit that land, and go to Moab. But under Levirate law, the Goel, or the Redeemer, could, if they were willing to be generous, they had to be willing. This was not something they were forced to do. No one would force them to do this. They had to be willing and they had to be generous enough to take it upon themselves to provide for this poor relative. They would have the right to buy back Naomi's land, not for themselves, but for her. But the problem with this situation, and this is why I think Naomi didn't go to him directly when she showed up in town and say, "Hey, here we are, we need your help," is that she knew that even if this kinsman redeemer was willing to buy back the land and give it to her, that there was a big caveat, and that was that this kinsman redeemer would have to marry Ruth. She is the surviving relative who has the potential to produce a family and an heir, to keep the name of that family alive. And that was the whole purpose, to keep the name of the family alive. And so Naomi is just thinking, what are the chances of that? Not only would Boaz have to buy back the land, which would be a tremendous act of generosity. He wasn't buying it for himself and for his family. He was buying it for the dead relative, the relative who had died or lost it. But he would have to marry this Moabite, the only survivor of Naomi's son, and that would be to establish the line. And who would spend that kind of money? Who would jeopardize himself by an interracial marriage? If Boaz is an older man and is well-established in the town, it's entirely likely that he might have had a wife and had children of his own. And it would have just been complicated. He would have had to have taken some of the inheritance from his children, use it to buy back the land in order to give it to Naomi and then raise up children and care for those children and all of that. I mean, it is pretty sacrificing that he would do that. And why? Why would he do this? It'd be hard enough to do it for a relative. It would be hard enough to do it for someone who is one of your own. But why would he do it for an outsider, to a foreigner of a different race and a different belief system? Why would he do this for an idol-worshipping enemy who was a cursed nation, cursed by God up until, what is it, the 10th generation? They weren't allowed to appear in the congregation. So it doesn't make any sense. And that's why Naomi, no doubt, didn't approach Boaz or one of her other kinsmen directly, because she thought the odds are terrible. And that's why she wanted to tell Ruth to stay back in Moab. But Ruth, under the direction and instruction of her mother-in-law, knows this is our one chance. And Naomi has some hope because she sees the graciousness that Boaz has shown her already. And Ruth, in an incredibly bold act, goes in the middle of the night to Boaz. I do not recommend this, you young ladies that are out there that are single. This does not work in our culture, but it worked then. Basically, what she was doing was she was proposing marriage. She was basically saying, marry me. Marry me. I'm asking you to bring me under your protection, to bring us under your protection and marry me. Would you do that? I want you to be a kinsman redeemer. Do you see just how gutsy and bold and wonderful this story is? These two women and the redemption that takes place. Last week we heard about Rahab, how gutsy she was. I mean, she turned her back on that entire mighty city of Jericho. She defied the leaders and the governors of that city, and she aligned herself with the enemy because she had heard about their God. And she was so bold and brazen, not only to ask that her life would be spared by these enemies, but that her entire family would be spared. And I don't care if you're a modern woman or a traditional woman or whatever, I dare you to find anyone nowadays that is that bold and that courageous or assertive as Rahab or Ruth. Don't you just love, and people say the Bible is chauvinist, it's misogynist, it's bigoted. I mean, look, these are stories of women that are recorded for us. We can say, women have a right. Women have a place in all of this. And the great dramatic part is that Boaz does take up the challenge, doesn't he? He does come through for them. He does marry Ruth as her kinsman redeemer. And at the end, you see not only Naomi's line restored, not only do you see that she is captured the heart of Boaz, and he has seen the sacrificial love of Ruth, and on and on and on. But now, because of Ruth, and because of what has taken place in this story, Naomi is spliced into the line of the Messiah, into the line of the family of David, and ultimately into the line of Jesus himself. Ruth has not just brought Naomi's name back, not just brought her family life back, but she has given Naomi a name that is above every name. She is in the line of Jesus the Messiah. Let me ask you a question. How many of you in this room would ever dream that 2,500 years from this moment that anyone would be studying your life? And here we are, studying the life of Ruth, little Ruth, this racial outsider, this poor widow with no prospects. Look what she's done. Look what she's done as she aligned herself with Yahweh, turned her back on everything that she had and said, if I have him, I have everything I want. What are we supposed to learn from a story like this? What are we supposed to learn? Yeah, it's a nice story. It reads like just a wonderful little perfect novel, you know? You're bored, you're four chapters, read the story and enjoy it. But no, there's lessons to be learned, and I'm going to pick out just a couple of them for you. First one is, this tells us about the absolute life-changing power of friendship. Let me tell you, friendship is one of the most important relationships on earth. And if you can count your friends on one hand in a lifetime, your good friends, you are a blessed woman. And let me tell you something that I've discovered that is as great as marriage is and as awesome as romantic love is, the essence of what makes marriage so good is friendship. It really is. And what makes romance even meaningful is friendship. That, my dear friends in my life, my life has been transformed at very significant pivotal points in my life by friends. I go into detail, but we're running out of time. Look at the effect of Naomi's friendship in the life of Ruth. What does Naomi say to her on the road? She says, what does Ruth say to Naomi? She says, I don't want my gods anymore. I want your God. Whatever God it is that has made you this kind of a mother-in-law who cares and loves me and cares enough about me that you would send me back when I know it would be easier for me to travel with you. I could be with you and help you on this journey. I could glean for you. I could cook for you. I could clean for you. But you send me back because you care about me. You're not caring about yourself. Whatever God it is that you have worshipped, that you have told me about, I have seen his hand in your life. I have seen how you love me self-sacrificially. And that God, Yahweh, the most exclusive God, not just some tribal deity who, you know, the God of fire, the God of water, the God of whatever. This God who says, I am the God of all gods and you must forsake all gods and I am the only one and you must worship me. This exclusive God has shown in you the most inclusive love to me, a Moabite. He has produced that kind of love in you. That is the God I want. I want that God. That was the friendship that Naomi showed to Ruth all those years in Moab, and it bore fruit. Do you know, sometimes we think in order to bring somebody to Christ that we need an evangelist, we need a rockin' sermon, we need to bring them here to hear Greg or Levi or one of these preachers who can really do an altar call, take them to a crusade. But do you know that 85% of the people that come to faith in a crusade are brought by a friend? It's been the testimony of a faithful friend who has cared and shared the gospel with them. Ruth knew Naomi's God was the most exclusive, and yet she says, your inclusive love, I should say, is what I want. So the life-transforming power of friendship. And second of all, that there are signs of hope in every life, no matter how hard it might be. So never, never lose hope. One of the great things about Ruth is if you match it up to Genesis or Jonah or the Gospels or any other book in the Bible, you see there's really nothing really supernatural going on here, is there? There are no miracles. There's no visions. There's no healings. There's no, you know, sudden appearances, no multiplying bread out of nothing. There's just mundane facts and just down-to-earth story about real people and real life. There's not even a dream. Like Joseph at least had dreams, right, and could interpret dreams, but there's nothing like that in this story. And Ruth is the book for those of us whose lives are pretty ordinary, pretty mundane, and going through hard times perhaps. When we read that Naomi comes back from Moab and she says, I'm empty, think of this, right next to her is who? Who's standing right next to her when she walks into Bethlehem? Ruth. But Naomi can't see it yet. In the ordinariness of our lives, standing right beside us, maybe right next to us, living next door, in a child, in a friend, in a relationship, in a sudden turn of events that seems, you know, unexpected, but very ordinary, not miraculous, could be the answer that God is going to use to work miracles in your life, to do changes in your life. This incredible treasure, this little Moabite, Ruth, this daughter-in-law, is the one God is going to use to completely turn her life right side up again. When she came back into town and Naomi says, I'm empty, all of her friends could see she wasn't completely empty. There was Ruth standing right beside her. And they're like, well, if you're empty and you have nothing, well, who is that? And Ruth is standing there thinking, yeah, I'm just a nobody. I'm just a Moabite girl. And I come to worship Yahweh. That's why I'm here. And yet God is going to use this sweet, well-meaning Moabite girl clinging to her mother-in-law to transform not only their lives, not only Boaz's life, not only Naomi's life, but all of our lives. All of our lives, this outsider who becomes an insider. Sometimes in life you're the Naomi to a Ruth, and sometimes you're the Ruth to a Naomi. They both at different times in the story were so significant in each other's lives, weren't they? That's why we need each other in the body of Christ. You need older women, you need younger women. We need to learn and glean from each other. You can't handle life by yourself, ladies. I hope and pray that as a result of this Bible study, you're going to make lifelong friendships. You're going to network with each other. You're going to find sisters who will stand with you and pray for you, because you cannot live a life of hope as a solo Christian without a church, without friends, without a family of God. Let me tell you, this church, my friends in this church have meant everything to me. In the hardest of times that I've been through, they've been there for me. The last thing that we look at is how upside down and unexpected the ways God works are in this story. It's easy to read this as a traditional story. You can say, well, okay, Kathy, you're saying how nonconformist and how different Ruth was and how gutsy and so on. But basically it's, you know, girl gets guy, girl gets baby, they live happily ever after, right? This is a traditional story. But if you look carefully at this story, at almost every point in this story, it isn't traditional. You have two women making up a very non-traditional family at first. You have a woman, the younger one, is the breadwinner in the family, right? Society would also tell you, tradition would also tell you that interracial marriage is not good, that you shouldn't do that. You shouldn't blend classes. You shouldn't blend heritage. You know, you're better off marrying among your own kind, that it's a no-no to do that, not wise. But here is Ruth, the Moabite, marrying Boaz, an Israelite, and God blesses that. Look at the salvation to the whole world comes through basically an interracial marriage. Amazing. And at the climax of the story, there is this amazing, astounding thing. The women of the village come to Naomi and they say, Naomi, you have to put yourself 2,500 years back in time and hear this the way it sounded then and let it shock you. They say, Naomi, Ruth is better to you than seven sons. Seven sons is the number of perfection. They were saying, Naomi, Ruth is better than the perfect family. If you could have had everything you desired in a family, let me tell you, this daughter-in-law, not little baby Obed, not Boaz is better to you. No, Ruth is better to you than seven sons. Everyone wanted sons, but they're saying Ruth was better than the perfect family Naomi could have ever wished for. God is not limited or bound by social conventions or social structures. He says, I'm not going to choose the firstborn son. I'm going to choose the secondborn son. I'm not going to choose the attractive woman, Rachel. I'm going to choose the unattractive woman, the unloved woman, Leah. I'm not going to choose the rich. I'm going to choose the poor. And that's why these genealogies are so fascinating. We read about Tamar and Rahab and Ruth and Bathsheba. How many times do we see that God is able to work in our most unexpected lives, right? In places that we don't see him ever having a chance to work. So how do I wrap this up? Try to be devout and courageous and loving like Ruth. Be willing to be a good friend. Use it to help others in need. Be hopeful. Get up tomorrow. If your day is bad, say, well, tomorrow's another day. Life gives you lemons. Make lemonade, right? That's the sermon? Is that what I'm going to leave you with today? No, I'm not going to leave you with that. Listen, Ruth is not just a story about a courageous and loving woman. Ruth would point us to Yahweh. She would point us to the God who gave her strength and hope and who transformed her life, that she said, could say, if I have Yahweh, I have everything. I'm willing to leave all this other stuff because that's nothing comparatively. She would point us to the God who left his home, who came into this hostile world, who lived not just at the prospect or possibility of being beaten and killed, but purposefully coming into this world, being willing to be beaten and killed for us. And here he is standing at our side, and he is saying, follow me. I am here. I will not let you go. I will cling to you. Hold on to me. Ruth saw Naomi a God worth sacrificing and leaving everything for. And he is there for us too. And he is saying the same thing to us. He is saying, will you be my disciple? Will you follow me? Amen. The band's going to come up and they're going to lead us in this song that we learned. Listen.